You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. This episode, we peel back the mythos behind the phenomena of urban legends in the company of Gail DeVos. Gail is a leading authority on folklore and other legends, and in her latest book, The Watkins Book of Urban Legends, she collects the first comprehensive collection of such tales. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. A big thank you to Katrina, my latest patron, and thank you to each and every one of you who also supports the show with your contributions. Mysteries and Monsters is across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit our website, mysteriesandmonsters.com, for news and episodes. Our exclusive merchandise store is available through TeePublic, and the link is in the show notes as usual. Our intro and outro music is performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his wonderful art, and the show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. So beware the hiding killer, the story of the hair-raising rabbit, demons who love to clean toilets, and even the humble crossroads as we brave the world of urban legends in the company of Gail. Urban legends have been with us since the art of storytelling began, and the modern media explosion in social media has seen some receive a new lease of life. In her latest book, The Watkins Book of Urban Myths, author Gail DeVos has collected a comprehensive collection of these tales from around the world. And a leading authority on folklore and urban legends, I am delighted to welcome Gail to this episode of Mysteries and Monsters. Gail, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
I love a book that in parts makes me chuckle, makes me frustrated, makes me scratch my head, and sometimes, on occasion, gives me the heebie-jeebies, Gail. And this collection of stories, which I think anybody who knows anything about such things will stumble across at least one, has a bit of everything in it.
Glad to hear that. I tried very hard to do that. One of the reasons, I mean, the other books I wrote sort of explored the urban legends more fully in many cases, but this book, I wanted people to realize how much we are embedded, in a sense, to the urban legend for our beliefs, for the way we move, for the way we do things. And sometimes they're good stories, stories, and sometimes they're not so good.
I think the thing that could surprise people is, obviously, it seems that there doesn't seem to be any sort of national boundary to a lot of these stories, Gail. Be you in Canada, America, the UK, Europe, even places like Japan and parts of Asia, you will see, Australia as well, you will see these stories slightly differing from continent to continent often, but the meat and bones of the actual story is usually the same. And it's remarkable that, do you think, as someone who has studied this particular strand of storytelling for so long, that it just shows both the ability of modern social media to sort of repurpose and reissue these over a far wider area than we ever used to be able to, then that there would be certain stories that you would think would be lost to time. But it seems that the internet is very clever in sort of updating some of them to give them a bit more of a modern feel.
Well, in the beginning, the stories were much more regional. And I think I talked a little bit about that in the book. You told the stories to the people that lived in the area. And then as things got more universal, first through letters and then through, you know, the multimedia, the localization became, or well, let's just say wider. It just became something that, here's a great story, I'm telling it to you, and then you want to tell it, but you don't really recognize Seba Beach, Alberta, so you're going to put it in Australia, where or, you know, Timbuktu. It doesn't matter. But then because you put it in a different location, then you have to tweak it a bit to make it real to that location. And that's when the individual differences come up in any case. A lot of it has to do with belief. It's because your story as the retailer in an area that you're familiar with, so you put your familiarity to use.
Mm.
Stories are the same, but the way they're told changes because of the teller. With the internet, is that those stories became much more static, because instead of a teller telling it to a listener, you've got a reader who is now informing a wider audience, yes, but instead of them retelling it, they're not cut and pasting it. So things aren't changed the same way as they used to be. They're not adapted the same way as they used to be.
I think it's very interesting. One that strikes me very early in the book is the hair-raising dog. Primarily because I saw somebody try and pass this off as a real story about a year ago. And thankfully, the internet sort of collectively shook their heads on this particular post, because it's such a well-known one over here. I've seen it as a scene in two different sitcoms in the UK where they look after a dog, comes into the house with a dead rabbit. They think, oh my God, we've killed we're dog sitting and it's killed the neighbor's rabbit. And then they sort of clean it up, put it back in the hutch. And then obviously everybody gets terrified because the poor rabbit was dead anyway. And now it's back in the hutch.
Right.
That is one of those stories that it, without wishing to sound like I'm pulling your leg over this, this one seems to have legs, because every time you think this surely can't keep going, it pops up. Because I remember the last time I saw it on a British sitcom was probably about 10 years ago, Gail, if that. And then, lo and behold, last year, I'm seeing somebody else talking about something, and they try and pass this story off as, oh, well, this happened to me. Unfortunately, my friend, no, it didn't. And people were even sharing the clip from the show, showing the story.
That's right. But it's such a good story.
Yes.
And it's one I remember telling it. On the radio, on national radio, CBC, here in Canada, in 1988.
Wow.
And people believed then, and I continue to tell it because I get such great reactions, such great conversation. And it's really hard to say, no, it didn't happen. It's truly a story. But then it gives me a chance to talk a little bit more about it. However, when it's such a good story, yes, they want to believe it. And yes, they want to retell it. And yes, they want to own it, because that's what you do with great stories.
It is. And it's surprising as well, because you can kind of imagine 40 years ago, the way people looked after dogs is probably very different to the way they are now. I'm not too sure what it's like in Canada, Gail, these days, but I would imagine it's very similar to here in the UK. That I remember as a kid growing up, you need to see stray dogs wandering about all over the place. These days, if you see one, it's quite unusual, and people are like, what's going on here? It's very odd. So I can kind of see its sort of origin story in that kind of environment, where dogs would be running into people's gardens and doing all kinds of naughty things. Whereas these days, unless you've specifically got somebody who lives next door to you and your dog just suddenly decides to go over the fence or through a hedge or something, the opportunity for this kind of scenario doesn't seem to be there. But like the rabbit, it seems to keep coming back to life every few years.
Well, if you live somewhere rural like I do,
yes,
it still happens. I mean, I live in a lakeside community, but we still have a lot of pets wandering around. And in fact, we have a lot of people who drop off their unwanted pets because somebody will look after it. They can't anymore. Yeah. So we do have that type of thing. But in this case, I keep seeing my own dogs. Yeah, they take off. They're friendly. They like to play. And then they go into the woods, and I'm not quite sure what they're doing there. Right?
Yes.
So it still depends on where you live. Mm. Whether that story has legs, if you will.
Yes.
Because if you're really rural, then it's different. And that's one of the reasons why, although the title says Urban Legends, I would prefer it to be contemporary legends, things that are happening in the real now, but not necessarily just in big centers.
Yes. I had to chuckle reading that particular section of the book where you refer to that experience of sharing the story with some Inuits who seemed to shake their head because they couldn't understand why you would waste such a good rabbit skin, which I think it just shows you that as we've kind of touched on there, you have to frame the story in the culture and the area that you are. And it's amazing that sometimes you don't think about these things until you put it in a particular situation. You think, well, when I read it, I was like, well, that obviously makes complete sense to me why they were like, well, why would you do that?
Right. Exactly. And part of it is that's what I'm saying, depending on your belief systems, when you look at many variants of the same story and you see a pattern, you realize society has similar beliefs. If you don't see the same kind of pattern, then you realize that belief may be fairly unique to a certain set of people, right?
Yeah.
So that's one of the things I love about being able to collect the stories from all over and then look at them and see the similarities and the differences. It's not the story so much, but the way the little details that tell us about the population and talk about the environment and talk about the beliefs of the people. There's so much knowledge in these stories.
Are you surprised sometimes when you see some of these stories with this modern twist and with your experience and your love of this particular subject? And as you said there, in regards to that, the particular rabbit story being mentioned in the 80s on radio, that some of these stories go back far longer than perhaps some people may imagine, because I know there are some stories that you can sort of look back at the birth of national media as these kind of stories. And I'd like to think that, as I say, I try not to be a cynical person, but sometimes if I hear a story or I read an article in a newspaper, there are usually little tells where you can kind of say, I'm not really sure that that's happened.
Right. And if you do enough digging and if your sources are reliable, you can find out that some of these stories predate, you know, modern technology and predate a lot. I mean, some of the stories that I tell, particularly the spider and the hairdo, you know, go back centuries. So, I mean, yes, it has changed, but that's one of the things that is so malleable about these stories. They adapt. They belong to us. They're in the public domain. We take them. We reuse them the way that we need to for whatever reason we're telling them. And then they go on. And sometimes we can go back and find the origin. Sometimes you cannot. But some of them are very old.
Yeah. Would you say we're in the sort of a new wave of these stories seeing new lights, as I mentioned on the introduction, with social media? Because I can kind of remember the sort of birth of email really taking off sort of the end of the 90s, Gale. And I remember specifically periods where you just get emails about certain things where it was always slightly tailored. Where I live in Sheffield, there's a very big shopping centre or a mall for you guys. And there would be stories about people wandering around offering perfume samples to ladies who would pass out in the car park and be robbed. And then you would see these stories pop up 5 years, 10 years down the line, and people said, oh, you've got to be careful, you've got to watch out for this. And you just look at it and say, well, there's no names, no dates, it's a very generic story. You can see it's been sent on by somebody else because you could always see the arrows on the emails below and so on. And obviously these chain emails were quite prevalent sort of the end of the 90s, the early noughties. Do you think we're having the similar kind of thing with things like TikTok and Instagram and things, where these unsubstantiated stories are just being repurposed for a modern audience, as it were?
Particularly with memes.
Yes.
You know, I mean, quite a few of my colleagues are studying the memes as contemporary legends because they're doing exactly the same thing that the story does. I mean, I like the story because I am a storyteller. I like the memes because I also teach about comic books and visual literacy. So both of those are really important to me in the, distribution of these tales. The stories change. Yes, by the way they are told by the media. The believability, I'm thinking with all the conspiracy theories, people are becoming less aware in some cases of even trying to find out whether these stories are real or not. If it agrees with what they believe, it must be true.
Yes, absolutely. And as we both know, girl, if it's on the internet, it must be true.
Yeah, exactly. You can always trust the internet.
Absolutely. I mean, another one that you mentioned in the opening chapter is the killer in the back seat. And this one,
right.
I've got a personal connection to this because I've had somebody tell me this story, hand on their heart, claiming it was true. But it's slightly different to the version you've got in the book. So the version I had was it was a dark, stormy night. And this lady was driving her car and there was a big box in the middle of the road, Gail. And so she thought, oh, well, I can't drive around it. I'm going to have to move this cardboard box. So she gets out of her car, moves the box, and she carries on driving for a bit. And then all of a sudden she notices the police flashing her. And she's like, oh, well, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not breaking the speed limit. The lights aren't out. I'm not drunk. I don't know what's going on here. So eventually she pulls over. And as she obviously stays in her car, and the police officer comes over and says, come with me, please, madam. And as she gets out, the police officer says, come on, and takes her out of the way. And then two officers run and arrest this killer that's laying in the back seat with a big knife. And she categorically told us that story was true. Nothing in the papers, nothing in the local media, nothing on the local news. This person was known for exaggerating certain aspects of life in general, shall we say, Gail.
Okay.
But it's one of those, once again, that it there are always slight variations of that. And I would imagine there's that version that I've just mentioned that somebody somewhere around the world is telling as we speak.
Oh, I'm sure it is. I remember this is years back when the stories were still fairly fresh for me anyways. And I was doing a workshop. Now I was in the school, in junior high school. So grade, I don't know, eight year, I don't know what that would be in the UK, but you know, teenagers, young teens.
Yes.
And I'm telling the story. So I told about the choking Doberman, because at that time it was about a Doberman. It's about different dogs now, but that time it was a choking Doberman. I told the killer in the back seat. I told a couple others that had to do with cars and danger. And all of a sudden, one of the teachers left, and she left for a long time. And when she came back, she said, I have to apologize. I said, I don't understand. She said, well, I was listening to your stories, and I thought, did I lock my door? Is my car safe? And so she left the school, went to her car, checked all around it, checked the back seat, drove home, checked that there was no Doberman hiding in, I mean, being held in the closet, came back to the school. So then I felt really bad because she believed it. Well, she didn't believe it. She just made her worry about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the reasons why your friend who told the story could tell it with such believability, because that's something that frightened her.
Yeah.
That could happen.
Yeah.
It really could happen as far as she was concerned.
Yes. It is surprising. I mean, I spoke to some regular guests on my show last year. We were talking about some Halloween legends, Gail. And tainted candy seems to be the one that doesn't die. It seems to happen all over the place. It's been things from pins to rat poison to ant poison, as you mentioned in the book, to people putting tacks in it, razor blades. I mean, quite how anybody can get these things in often is beyond the realms of possibility, but people don't care. And you see it occasionally where people will claim that their children have been given drugs or whatever, and then these stories always appear over Halloween, and then there's no follow-up story. Anybody would think these were made up, girl. But when I was talking to my guests, who were David Weatherly, Chad Lewis and Kevin Lee Nelson, who specialize in sort of folklore and legends, I was saying to them that here in the UK we did actually have a tainted sweet situation here that happened in the 1850s in a town called Bradford, where somebody accidentally mixed arsenic into a mint mixture and 20 people died. And that's a matter of fact. And I was saying to these chaps, Do you think that this is one of those few examples where there is a story? It's not really the same, because obviously back there, trick-or-treating just wasn't a thing in the United Kingdom. It didn't sort of come in till really catch fire here till sort of the 80s, after E.T. had been such a big success and American culture had sort of been shown on TV a lot more here. And so the idea of kids going out on Halloween dressed up and going house to house for candy and sweets only really started from that point on. So you've got like a gap of 100-odd years. But very quickly here in the UK, I remember as a kid being told by friends, my parents won't let me go out trick-or-treating because people are putting razor blades in chocolate bars.
Well, it's that fear, and I think more than the fear of being poisoned or ingesting something that is harmful, it's the fear of going out and addressing strangers. Even if you're in a small town, and you know everybody, but Halloween, you're dressed differently. People who are at the door are dressed differently in many cases. I don't know about there, but sometimes they dress up here. Mm-hmm. All sorts of things happen in the realm of possibility. Therefore, somebody could actually go out and poison someone. Now, the story that you told, the one that actually happened, that was an accident, pure and simple.
Yeah.
The story is looking at people who do it on purpose, which is much more malicious, and equally as frightening. But the tendency to blame the stranger rather than say, "Oh my goodness, what an accident," makes the story stronger. In that case, because it could happen, because that person that lives in that house, we know how nasty that person is. We've seen that nasty person do whatever, right? And so you know you can't trust that nasty person. I have it on good authority.
Well, it takes you back to those kind of childhood films that you grow up with, where all the kids in the neighborhood are scared of the old person who lives in the ramshackle house on the street, who more often than not is actually the hero of the story and saves the day.
That's right. But we still have that. Almost in every town and area, neighborhood, there's a haunted house, whether it's really haunted or not. There's a house that people are always a little nervous about, or more than a little, because it's different, or because they don't know the person there. A person is an isolationist or whatever reason. So yeah, we have those still. And so the stories still work.
I mean, there's so many in here that I'd forgotten about some of them, Gail, until I read them in this book. The scuba diver in the tree is one of those that when I heard it years ago, it really made me chuckle. But for anybody who isn't aware of this, what is the scuba diver in the tree?
All right. Well, this one is so bizarre because it keeps showing up. But I mean, it's a simple story that when you have firefighting planes, in many cases, or helicopters with buckets to fight fires, particularly wildfires, so you have these planes that come in and they scoop up the water in their buckets or underneath the plane itself, and then they go and fly over the fire and drop the load trying to, put out the fire. Well, in one case, after the fire was put out, they discovered a scuba diver way up high in a tree, and it was lodged there, and they could not figure out how the scuba diver got up there. I mean, it had full tanks, had everything, unfortunately dead, so he couldn't explain it. But they are, after a while, after some investigation, they discovered that while that scuba diver was in the water, the plane came in, scooped up the water with the scuba diver, and when it let out the load of water over the fire, the scuba diver went too. So it's impossible. But one of the things I talk about in the book, and one of the things that happened, is when we had a forest fire very close to us, a wildfire. And I'm, as I said, I'm on a lake, so it's a fairly deep lake. the water bombers were coming through, and then they would go around over our heads in our house, and we could look at the bottom of the plane. They were very close to us, and you could see not only was there a grill, but there was not enough space for a scuba diver to be scooped up. Yeah. So we just sat there and laughed. But that story has been told so many times, and you're still going, how do you believe this? How? Sometimes it's a fisherman or yes. a fishing person, if you like, with a still with a fishing rod stuck up in the tree. Right. But there it is. One of those favorite stories, and they show it shows up in the public domain. Yeah. It also shows up because it's in the public domain in your movies and your books and your stories.
Well, that's I think often as well. This is the thing we forget, that for some people, when they're hearing these versions or these tales, depending on where it's come from and where they live, Gail, I think often we forget the input that popular culture also has, because a lot of the stories you've included in the book, and I'm sure many of us, if we sat down and thought about it, they've been used in sitcoms and comedy films where you would have mix-ups or stories that are told that somebody goes, oh, well, that sounds like a good sort of comedy scene I can use for my particular film or show. And that ends up perpetuating, as I mentioned earlier on about the rabbit and the dog story. I've seen that right. in two programs here. I would imagine American and Canadian comedy shows have used it as well. It is strange sometimes, like the going to a cafe and getting some food, getting a drink or something, coming back and somebody else is, you think somebody's eating your food, but you've actually right. gone back to the wrong table. And that's turned up several times in films and TV.
Right. I think I even mentioned about the, you know, the court case about it because yes. they were talking about plagiarism. And yet the story is out there. Anybody could tell basically the same story because it's been told for so long and so many different ways, biscuits or Kit Kats or meals, whatever it is. It's something that we've all done. We've never gone back and sat down at the wrong table and went, oh, I'm in the wrong place, or, you know, that type of thing, or done something kind of embarrassing and you hope nobody notices. And yet, because you did something embarrassing, you get caught. It's, you know, it's that kind of story can be so true in the sense that we're always terrified of doing something so stupid that people will laugh at us.
Is it surprising as well for someone with your level of expertise in this particular field, Gail, that you will see some of these contemporary legends that are always given as absolute cast iron fact? And one I can think of off the top of my head is the average person eats 6 spiders a year through their sleep.
Right.
And I'm thinking, how has anybody studied this? Firstly, that's the first thing that comes in my mind. I'm thinking, how do they know this? I'm always thinking, who have they been watching to get these results, Gail? I'm not the kind of person... Ironically, I would say I'm not the type of person who would swallow such a claim in regards to these type of things, Gail. And yet this seems to be one of those things that it's a fact everybody knows, but there doesn't seem to be any actual substance to it.
Well, no, but it's been told as true and it has been written about as true. So why would you argue with it? It's obviously true. Same thing with bubblegum. Right? He was chewing yes. bubble gum or swallowing seeds, you know, and then the children beside you, the watermelon. I mean, those stories were told to me when I was a child, so my mother would sort of make sure I didn't swallow the bubble gum or be careful of how I, you know, you use those stories and all of a sudden they become true because why would your mother lie to you?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So yeah. Obviously it's true. Yeah.
Well, we had a very similar one, like apple pips. If you swallowed apple pips, Gail, a tree would start growing inside of you.
Yeah, exactly. Just think about it.
Yeah.
I go back to the fact that, especially in that story, I keep thinking about Little Red Riding Hood being swallowed up by the wolf or granny, and the digestive system didn't start working on them. That they got, you know, when the woodcutter came and saved them in that version,
yes.
That they were perfectly whole and fine. Like, how did that happen? That's the opposite of the Pip, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it makes me chuckle because I remember as a younger person, if somebody always said, oh, tell us a fact, I would always say, Daddy long legs are the most venomous insect in the world, but their fangs are too weak to break human skin. That was one of the first things that I found out on the internet wasn't true, Gail. But I'd spent my entire life till I was about 28 thinking that that was true. And then I checked online and it was nonsense. And I cannot tell you where I got that from. I don't know if somebody told me, or as often is the case, you might read an article somewhere in a local paper or a newspaper with no facts or names or dates or anything that you can sort of follow it back to. And so for me, that's always stuck with me over the years because I was absolutely convinced that that was a fact. And so I suppose here in the UK, it's a bit different because to all intents and purposes, we don't have venomous arachnids. Obviously, certain people can have allergic reactions to them. And we've got what are called fake widows here, which are part of the black widow family, but not as venomous. You can have a nasty reaction to their bite, but most occasions it won't kill you. And so I think here it's quite prevalent to think that those things that seem to just appear in late autumn and get on everybody's nerves for about 3 weeks, if they really wanted to, they could kill you, but they just can't.
Right. Yeah, there's that safety net, right?
Yes.
Okay. You're okay. You just have to sort of know that they'll be fine. And tolerate and take it easy. Yeah. But if you lived in Australia, you'd know darn well that almost anything could kill you. Everything almost.
Yes. Yes, that is true. So once again, when you take the story out of somewhere as animal friendly as the UK, it takes on a very different perspective.
Well, one of the things that's special about spiders is that more people are afraid of spiders than almost anything else.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing to be afraid of. Not because they're poisonous so much. I don't know what it is, the fear.
Mm.
I did have a reaction with a principal phoning me and saying I got a complaint about your storytelling session from a mother. Her daughter was afraid of spiders, and you told the story about the spider and the hairdo, and now she will not go to bed. She's terrified, and you know, and the principal just said, "I needed you to know this, but I'm not doing anything about it because you know that person needs to handle her fears." But that's one of the problems sometimes of going out and telling stories to people that you don't know. As a storyteller, I'm doing that all the time. And so I have to be very careful as somebody who's monitoring the audience to see that that person's not frightened of spiders or that person's not, you know, like what their reactions are. Things that I think are very, very, you know, benign can be terrifying for people. Things that I think are frightening, they don't care at all. So one of the things that you discover when you're telling those kinds of stories is that you have to be very careful about your audience or your story. So sometimes, for example, I don't tell scary stories to young children, even though they beg for them. because I know if you're listening to a scary story, what happens is it doesn't matter what the thing in the story is, your most basic fears come to the forefront and you're terrified and you don't know why. Yeah. So you're afraid maybe not of spiders but of something else that's in the story. Because it's an oral story and you're into the story, it can frighten you much more so than a televised story or a written story. So that's the power of story. But it also means as a storyteller you also have to be very careful about that.
Yes, I once learned a valuable lesson in that of not answering children's questions truthfully, Gail. I remember one of my friend's sons was always very inquisitive, and I was the family friend who basically would be asked about everything from why is the sky blue to where do sharks go to have babies to do you know about this superhero to everything? And this one particular day, he said to me, do bears eat people? And I said, obviously, of course they do. Of course they do. I said, but, you know, we live in the UK, and obviously we don't have any bears running around here, so you're okay. 30 minutes later, he's in absolute floods of tears. He thinks a bear's going to come through the front door and eat him. And I couldn't get my head around why he was so frightened about something that doesn't live in the UK. But I learned a valuable lesson then. Sometimes you have to be economical with the truth.
Exactly. Or find out why you're asking.
Yes, somebody told you about this. Am I being set up here? But yes, it is sometimes, I think, often you can try and encourage children's learning and inquisitive natures. And sometimes you've got to remember what we can talk about in quite a balanced manner. When you're 7 or 8, you don't have that nuance and that knowledge to kind of supplant the answer to the question you may ask.
That's right. So that's why, basically, when I tell stories, the most part, not always, I have an older audience because I have a twisted mind. I like those stories. I like cute, sort of sweet stories. I mean, I can tell some, but I'd rather tell ones that are meaty and juicy. So urban legends or the contemporary legends are, you know, my go-to for many reasons. But part of that is because I delight in being able to tell a story and then talk about where it may have come from or how it appears in popular culture, because I love the intersection between folklore and popular culture. That's my main frame of reference for almost everything. And you can't do that with the very young. But at the same time, you need a good story. So you pull out other types of stories rather than the contemporary legends. No, it's just a soapbox about making sure that the stories that you're telling, even if they're from my book and they said I heard them when I was young, make sure that you're careful about the age group.
Yeah, I shall bear that in mind as I have a new batch of young friends' children to make sure I don't some friends who have had some young children. So I make sure I'm a bit more experienced these days, girl.
Just checking.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. One thing that also made me chuckle is the section you talk about cursed paintings, primarily because we've got a mutual friend. I'm friends with Dr. David Clark, and obviously you are.
Right.
And I've got to know David since doing the show and met with him several times and seen him speak. And when he did a contemporary legends sort of festival for a weekend here in Sheffield a few years ago, David kindly fetched his collection of crying boy pictures.
Right.
And it was remarkable for somebody that knows the story and knows David and knows his origins as a reporter working for the Sheffield and Rotherham Stars, as they were now. It's all the Sheffield Star that covers the area. All the local versions of Gone Gale. This is obviously a story that started very close to here, not far from where I'm sitting speaking to you today. And obviously David reported on this, and this is one of those stories, I think, that kind of sparked his love of this particular subject and has obviously seen him develop into a real sort of connoisseur of folklore, both of the past and in the modern era. And whilst he was giving this lecture, it was striking to me, Gail, that even though I know about these pictures and the era and the fact that people's homes are not like they were in the mid-80s with chip pans and badly wired houses and all kinds of stuff, coal fires and all kinds of things, and obviously a lot of these pictures were painted on a certain material that was quite flame retardant, and all this sort of backstory about Bergerlin being this cursed painter and all this, even though knowing that there was very little factual evidence to support anything other than circumstances and materials being the main problem, people were actively going out of their way to not go near these pictures, even in 2019, Gail.
Up to last year, even. David got rid of those pictures, by the way. Yeah, no. The question is, Paul, what if it sort of is true? What if that painting is cursed? What if? Now, would you take a chance? And why?
Probably asking the wrong person.
So that's what ends up happening, is that you know logically that it didn't happen.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you act as if it did. I'll just go back. This isn't anything to do with the crying boy. Well, it may be in a case it does. But I remember, I don't know if you had the story of the child, that a blonde child that was taken, went missing, was taken into the washroom, hair cut and died. And then they took, it's supposed to happen in West Edmonton Mall here in Alberta or in Disneyland or wherever. And so the child was kidnapped because the blonde hair had been died and had gone. Well, we were in Rome when my blonde daughter was, she's about five, and I'm holding on to her hand on the bus. And somebody got in between me and her and started pushing her away. I knew that was a story. I knew very well it was a story. And my first thought is, my blonde baby, they're trying to take my blonde baby away. And so even though I knew the story, I studied the story, I still reacted as if it was a true, you know, a truism, because my fear right then was, you know, as a mother.
Yes.
Other than as a scholar, you know. And yeah, it was a pickpocket. But and they couldn't care less about my blonde baby. They just wanted my wallet.
I suppose it's surprising that you get these variations of certain ones as well, like the crying boy, Gail, that once you seem to put one to bed, even though this one does pop up, I've seen it appear on social media recently. I always, and then just think that I'm not even going to bother. Is that you've got other paintings that have since become sort of possessed or accursed or whatever. You've got, I think, is it the Rain Woman? There's another famous one.
Yes.
You've got that very famous story that's attached to the painting. Is it Landseer's painting of the two polar bears fight eating right. crew? And this story that it depresses people so much that they sadly take their own lives. And you think sometimes I'm not sure what it is about these particular painting stories, Gail. They all seem quite dark compared to some other urban myths and legends and contemporary stories.
Well, some of the stories truly are dark, and I tended to stay away from some of those. Although, because the book, the intent of the book was entertainment, right?
Mm.
That's more of what this book was than anything else. I mean, there are some dark things in there, but if you look at some of those stories and you realize that, yes, the darkness is definitely there. And some of it has to do with the darkness that we have within our own selves or within our community. And those tend to end up being conspiracy theories in many cases. Because that's when you're starting to look at the negative rather than this is a great story, this is funny.
Mm.
So most of the stories that I tried to look at were mostly either ghost stories, supernatural, or less harmful, if you like, because I wanted people to appreciate the story rather than become terrified. I wasn't writing horror, but those stories are there, and they are definitely very strong in many cases. But they're not my kind of story.
Mm.
So I think that's a personal thing as a collector, as a researcher. I put my own boundaries on things that make me feel comfortable or uncomfortable. And so I acknowledge that they're there. I just also acknowledge that I don't need to talk about them.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I mean, some of these don't need any more fuel, especially in this day and age, Gail.
Right.
They seem to have lives of their own, as it were.
Right. But the going back to the paintings, that's more of a supernatural kind of thing. It's a darkness thing, but it also helps us control or face some of our fears. What are we really afraid of? I mean, some of those paintings are somebody coming out of the painting. How realistic is the painting that you have on your wall? If it's really realistic, could that happen?
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. I mean, it is. I mean, as a lover of art, I have to say I prefer the darker elements of art and have an unusual taste, I would say. But I've yet to see a painting that's left me terrified. And I've seen some strange ones over the years, Gail, in certain galleries, but I've never been moved in a way that frightens me. I've been moved by the power of the picture, or the scenes that it might be depicting, or the history about it, or something like that. But I've never been frightened to my sort of soul by a painting and thought, oh my goodness, this is one of those things. But as you said, in regards to the paintings, what if? And I think when you look at some of these legends that have grown up around inanimate objects, dolls are a prime example of this, Gail. Right. You think, what if Robert the doll, I have to say, is probably my favourite, primarily because of everything around him. Like, you have to ask permission to take his picture when you go and visit him. The fact that people send him joints through the post as though that's to help him chill out or something, Gail. I'm not really sure what that's going on with. And it's always made me chuckle once I discovered that people just randomly send joints through the post to Robert the doll, which is, I suppose, there are worse things they could be sending him. But you see this, and especially in modern horror films, you know, you can't move some years without a haunted doll film surrounding you, almost as if like they are animated dolls come to life, Gail.
Right. And I mean, you can correlate that with fear of clowns.
Yes.
But that, again, it correlated with something that there is another what if. What if there is something very sneaky and horrific hiding behind that very smiley face?
I think with things like that, the thing that has always struck me, Gail, is I have an interest in the psychology of serial killers, I have to say. And for me, I can kind of understand, because I'm a child of a certain era. So seeing Poltergeist when I was 10 put me off clowns for life. Ironically, my brother had a very similar looking clown. It wasn't as sort of long limbed as that one. It was a bit more fluffy, but it was a big one. It was about 4 foot tall. And after we watched that film, that clown didn't stay in the house much longer. Because you never know, Gail. You never know.
That's fine.
And we just moved out of one haunted house. We didn't want to have anything else move into our new place. Especially if it took a liking to the clown. But like you say, when you see these kind of things, and very similarly here, Sheffield Children's Hospital had a wing repainted with loads of clowns, and all the parents complained saying that their kids were frightened of it.
Right.
Even in, I think that was about 10 years ago. But you, like you say, there are often kernels of truth as to why these things suddenly get frightening. And for me, you only have to look at perhaps character like John Wayne Gacy, who made his living on occasion as a part-time entertainer, as a clown. And then even though he wasn't killing people dressed as a clown, as far as we're aware of, who knows what went on in that horrific house. But I think when you get something like that enmeshed with someone so violent and repugnant as Gacy was, that it doesn't take a great leap of faith, Gail, for that kind of to all get sort of mushed together, and therefore all of a sudden John Wayne Gacy is the killer clown, and therefore we all need to be terrified of clowns.
That's true, because you just don't know. Mm. And that's one of the reasons why people tell these stories, in many, not all of them, but for some of them, is just in case. And I'm going to tell you this just in case. I don't believe it, but just in case. It's a hard thing to know the reason why people are telling these stories. But when you look at it, it seems to be that they're trying to validate their own fears by sharing their concerns with somebody else, in many cases. They're also trying to see if you, the listener, are of the same belief patterns that they have. So if you laugh at them, then they know, whoops, no, you are not the same type of thinker as I am. Or if you get very concerned and share that concern with them, maybe you found another person who loves serial killers or somebody. So sometimes the stories, that's what the stories are told for, is to find out whether this friend, old friend, thinks the same way as you do, has the same concerns as you do, has the same beliefs as you do. And so the stories become barometers, thermometers. There's so many reasons why the stories are told.
I mean, sometimes they're kind of heartwarming. And I know there's one I've got personal experience, and I know you mention it in the book, and your husband has as well, which is Greyfriars Bobby in Edinburgh.
Oh, right.
And here's the thing, Gail. This shows you the power of these kind of stories. I know that there's no sort of charm in touching Bobby's nose on the statue just round the corner from the graveyard. But can you guess what I did when I saw it?
Well, of course you did.
Because you never know, do you?
Yeah, exactly. Go to Bermantown and look at the donkey and how the fingertips have taken away the outer level of it's and there's other places as well. When I was in Asia, there were places there that you definitely needed to touch.
Yeah.
Because if you did, that luck, that fortune would be yours somehow.
Yeah. And it's strange because even that whole story, it's very ropey, the whole Greyfriars story. But it's lovely because it shows the bond between a person and their pet. And this, it's a love that often you can't explain it. It's just an emotional feeling that overwhelms anybody who loves animals, that we have that sort of connection with them that's on a sort of different level to any other kind of relationship we have as humans. And what struck me more, and I didn't know this until I went in, because I did the whole ghost tour, so I got the double trip of dealing with the Mackenzie poltergeist as well as Greyfriars Bobby. So when you walk into the graveyard for round the corner from the statue, obviously Greyfriars Bobby's grave's there,
right?
And I was blown away because in front of it there's a big pile of sticks and dog toys and treats and also and the guide we had from on the ghost tour, who was brilliant. She said, "Oh, people come from all over the world and they leave in presents." And I was thinking, why? Why are they doing this? This makes no sense. But it just shows you that even into places such as the States and Japan and China, when people come to Edinburgh, Greyfriars Bobby is one of the things that's on their tick list. It's got to be done.
Right. It's an amazing thing, isn't it?
Mm.
It's, again, it's where we look as a people, perhaps, for something good. Mm. And that's something good. Some of us look for other things as well. I mean, you're on a ghost tour.
Yes. Yes.
But, you know, while you're there, it's that dog is symbolic of something so deep.
Yeah, it was definitely a two-for-one, that, because like I say, Greyfriars Bobby, I'm quite, you know, I find it quite a nice story, even though I don't think there's much truth in it, if any, at all. And I was
think any, but okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I mean. You know, that's I'm being polite about it, Gail.
Right. Okay.
I think it's a wonderfully tall tale. But the Mackenzie poltergeist, I know that story back to front, and there's very little to it at all. And to be honest, the worst thing about that particular story is, for me, is the bit where the two boys get the skull out of the grave and start playing football with it to impress some girls they were with. That we know happened. But everything else, I mean, like I say, I've been there. I can see that. You can't fall in, and there's no way you can get in through the back. It's not that big an entrance, really.
Right.
And it just strikes me as peculiar. It's become one of those, and the cynical side of me will suggest that, some people make a fair whack out of people going round and saying, "Here's the Mackenzie poltergeist, careful you don't get scratched."
Right.
But I'm sure those two things are not linked, Gail.
Right. I'm not going there. So do you go to graveyards wherever you travel?
I enjoy them. I find them fascinating. I think they're a really interesting way to learn about an area. I like the design. I like history. So I find it quite interesting. I'm not just wandering around hoping something's going to jump up and get me. I'm not going for the thrills. Wherever I go, I do tend to sort of have a look, because I appreciate sometimes the stories that are just there, and obviously where we are here in the north of England, we've got some infamous locations where you have some graveyards that are so fascinating and so old,
right,
that for me, I consider them a must do if I go anywhere new. I always try and visit the graveyard just in case, just for a little nosy about. And I've, like I say, I've been around Greyfriars when I went to Eme, which is obviously famous for the plague village here in the UK. That's a fascinating place. Even when I went to Todmorden on a UFO pilgrimage, Gail, I went in their graveyard, found a cat just chilling out. That was as worrying as it got in there.
Right.
But it's something I just find deeply interesting, because occasionally you might stumble across something that's really fascinating that until you go there, you might not even consider it. I mean, there's a place sort of halfway between here. Well, it's not that close to us, actually. It's nearer the coast, which is called Rudston. It's a small village on the east coast of England. And they've got a monolith in their graveyard, which has been there, they think, 3,500, 4,000 years. The tallest monolith in the UK. Most of it's underground. But for me, I'm fascinated because I've heard so many things about this. People still come and leave offerings there. There's a church built smack next to it, Gail. And then 20 yards away is a Roman graveyard. So three different religions and three different belief systems all congregated in that particular area and found it important. But obviously the monolith was there first. And even though people would disagree with why that was placed there, they also found it a place that they thought we need to hold reverence here.
Right. Yeah, well, graveyards are also a place that I like to go to as well. Mm. And sometimes the reason why I ask is sometimes you go to places, graveyards, if you like, and you find things that are fascinating, but then you can't find anything more.
Yeah.
Especially if you live out here where there's not a lot of history being told about some places. And then you have to tell the story.
Mm.
And as you tell the story, you start adding bits and pieces from somewhere else, from here, from there, from your imagination or whatever. And that's how these stories often grow about a certain graveyard or a certain place, because we love to explore what it is. And if you can't find out what it is, then you have to, or in that case, then you don't know anything about that. You go, I need to know something about that. And if I don't know anything about it, I'm going to tell it this way, because I'm sure this is what happened, or maybe it's close to it. You know, so you start telling the story, and that's where some of our best fiction comes from. Times they keep growing and being told to other people, and then all of a sudden you have a legend about a place that has nothing to do with reality. But that's what's been told so well for so long by so many people. And so that's what fascinates me, not only the grave itself, but the story behind it. Yes. And how it got there.
Yeah, it is striking sometimes, as you say, as we're talking about cemeteries, you will see these certain ones in the States, especially. There seems to be quite a lot of them in America for some reason, Gail, where there will be a cursed grave or a cursed statue. Or if you walk the wrong way around the graveyard, you're invoking some negativity to approach you in some form. Or you got that if you touch a certain statue, then you die, which is one of those, well, if somebody goes there on their own and they touch the statue and die, how does anybody know what's happened? But that's one of those things you can sometimes torpedo some of these stories. Do you think this is just one of those things that's always been there? Because essentially, graveyards are the resting place of the departed, and therefore, regardless of any curse or fear attached to them, they are a place of sadness for some, and a place of remembrance and joy for others, because whatever happens in their life, they can always visit that loved one that they've lost, regardless, Gail. It's a permanent reminder. And so for as many people who find them unsettling, there are probably people who find some comfort, as strange as that may sound to some. But I understand why some people will continue to make pilgrimages on Christmas and birthdays and things like that, because they feel like they're as close as they can be to that particular person since they passed. It doesn't seem like there's a sort of set rules for this. I'm quite surprised how many variations of things that go on in graveyards are there, especially in the States.
Well, I'm thinking in many cases it's that we, as North Americans in many cases, are not very comfortable with the whole idea of death and dying.
Mm.
And so if you're not comfortable with something, then it becomes something that you become frightened of or nervous around. And so if you're not finding comfort of going to a graveyard, you're feeling sort of apprehensive, and that apprehensiveness turns into some sort of fear. And if you're afraid, there's got to be a reason. And so maybe it's because there's something here to be afraid of. And as I walked around that particular grave, there was a really cold feeling. So I know that there was something there that might harm me.
Mm.
Regardless if it's a breeze that just came up or whatever reason. But then you start putting these things together, and yes, it becomes a place that the supernatural is there. It becomes a place of curses. It doesn't work that same way if it happens to be comforting to you. For many teens, it becomes a place of challenge. I dare you.
Yes.
I dare you to go there. I dare you to sit on that grave or to, you know, do something. And then if you do it, I'm sure that you may not live, or not forever anyways. And none of us do.
Yes.
So, you know, you don't know how it works. I don't know. I've never been afraid in a graveyard.
Yeah.
I'm like you. I like to go. I like to see. I like to read as much as possible of the headstones and sort of discover my own stories.
Yes.
I may not go and tell everybody them, but some of them are absolutely amazing.
Yes.
And I want to know more.
Yeah.
And that's how people are remembered, because their story is still being told.
Mm-hmm. I think there is that kind of aspect to it. I mean, sometimes you'll find them and it seems quite odd how long they've been going. I think I'm thinking of the Crying Mary story, which seems to have been around for nearly 100 years, which I think is in Michigan, isn't it?
Right.
That seems to be one of the oldest ones. Or is that me, Gail? Are there other ones that match that kind of thing? Because I've seen a couple of stories about this, the Black Aggie one, especially, because I think that's one of the most incredible pieces of art I've ever seen made for a grave.
Right.
I just thought that's phenomenal. And the fact that it's now been moved and just stuck in a courtyard somewhere, I think I'd find that more unsettling seeing it where it is now than I would have stumbling across that in a graveyard.
Right, right. Especially as you know why it was moved.
Yes.
You know, yeah. Well, the artwork is definitely, in some cases, so amazing. Some cases it's really not, and that's unfortunate too. But I mean, I was in Prague at the old synagogue. Have you been there? Their graveyard where it's been left to fall. So like it's just grave upon grave upon gravestone upon gravestone, and it, you know, the history in there. Just you take a deep breath and you just know how much has been there, and that's totally amazing. And then you go to my mother-in-law's hometown, where every 50 years they dig up, or 100 years, 50 years, I think, they dig up the old graves and get rid of the bones because there's not enough room.
Mm.
So those graves are only there for so long. So you have totally different ways of looking at a graveyard. That's, you know, and then there's other societies that don't have headstones at all.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
You know, and what happens there? I don't know.
Mm. I mean, obviously, that's one of the biggest tropes and cliches in American supernatural history, isn't it? This constant, oh, it must be built on a Native American.
Well, of course, because yeah, that's going to terrify you.
Yeah, but this is one of those. I think it's another one that's been so cemented in it. I think I read an article last year, Gail, about this, and I think they found 76 horror films from about 1975 onwards that use the Native American burial ground as a trope as to why something's gone horribly wrong or why a house is haunted.
Right, right. You have to thank Stephen King for much of it.
Yes.
You know, if it works for him, it's going to work for everybody else too. Yeah, it's an interesting trope. But I mean, one of the things I look at is cultural appropriation.
Mm.
And I looked about it in the couple of years ago when I was doing a presentation for ISCLR about the Wendigo and cultural appropriation.
Yes.
And the figure of the Wendigo, which is First Nations, has been taken and twisted so much by the horror industry in the non-Indigenous world, that you don't even, they don't even know where the Wendigo came from, or a lot of people don't know, or it's one of those horror film things. And you look at how people who don't respect one culture take things and remodel it and repurpose it. I don't know, maliciously, they don't. And unconsciously, perhaps, or without thought. But what is happening now, of course, is that people whose voices and culture have been taken are getting their voices back. I don't know what's happening in the States right now when they're trying to shut all that down again. But what we're finding is that we're going to be reclaiming, people are going to be reclaiming those old sacred stories, and you're not going to find as many people using the Wendigo or haunted graveyards or Indian graveyards. Anyway, I'm hoping that's what's going to happen, because people are going to start going, no, that's not acceptable. Can't tell those.
Absolutely, I completely agree. And it is noticeable, as someone with a love of horror, that sort of cliche about why a house is haunted seems to have really fallen away over the last 10 years. I think we've got a lot of sort of switched on and clued up people in the, I mean, horror films are usually a bit more, and directors and script writers are usually a bit more culturally sensitive these days. I think if they have got tired of something, it's usually when you see people who don't tend to specialize or work in that field particularly often, who will fall back on these old cliches and cultural misappropriation, Gail, and thankfully it seems to be moving on. As someone who knows a fair bit about the legends of and stories of the Wendigo and its sort of inception into the modern era and Swift Runner and the like, I'm aware of where it comes from and what it refers to. I'm also aware of the modern version bears very little resemblance to the First Nations version, and so thankfully doing this show, I'm able to sort of filter the crap out in regards to that and deal with the actual Indigenous story rather than the reinterpretation of it. But you see this quite a lot, and I suspect it happens, like you say, sometimes people go, oh, that's scary, we don't know much about it, and sometimes they will do it with the best intentions, and sometimes obviously some people won't. But thankfully these things seem to be, we seem to be moving away from a lot of this nonsense. But I suppose also you get the aspect of occasionally things pop up, quite literally from the ground, Gail, where you'll have these abandoned cemeteries that have been left for forever. And sometimes, I mean, even here in the UK, we had a very famous incident with an abandoned village called Warren Percy, which ended up being the first evidence of people being killed for suspected being a revenant or a vampire.
Right.
Which nobody had ever heard about, and it was just discovered by chance when they were doing excavations. And so you get these things that turn up, but then you also have places like Lake Lanier, which is one of those places when every time I see a program about it, I just think, what on earth are they drinking around there that makes everybody go nuts? Because one of the biggest legends about that particular place is that, well, they just filled the lake in and didn't leave the graves. And I remember seeing a documentary where there was an official from the Forestry Commission who said that it was categorically not true. I've seen footage of that lake. There are gravestones in that lake. There is no shadow of a doubt, girl. Now, are the Discovery Channel lying to us?
Yeah. Good question.
Because it's not that far. They didn't go that far in. They basically went in about 20 feet, and apparently the gravestones were there. And they showed it, and the names and everything. So it wasn't like that, oh, we think that might be a gravestone. They were filming it going, this is a graveyard here.
Yeah. Yeah. Bizarre. Bizarre.
Yeah. I mean, we've got a similar one here when we had a reservoir built, Gail, and obviously they basically evacuated the village and left most of the buildings standing. That has a legend that on a certain night you can still hear the church bell toll under the water.
Various different ones. That is another trope that's all over the world about the buried church bells.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when we had a massive heat wave here in the UK about 7 or 8 years ago now, obviously the reservoir level dropped to a point that you could still see the old village.
Right.
And they had to basically tell people to stop going. Because people were getting stuck in the mud. Because usually it's under like 200 foot of water. And so it's not the best place to go for a walk, Gail, really. But it's obviously these are established things. It's not like people have made them up. You can see them on certain days. I've seen stories the same from Spain, from Italy, from France. Depending on the weather and the time of year, the water level can drop and you can see. So I know you have these strange stories sometimes in the States where the same things happen. You've got that wonderful story about that lake that used to be there 100 years ago. They got rid of it and now it's decided to come back, and and all the farmers are like, what on earth's going on? Which I think's in California somewhere.
Well, we have them here too, and all of a sudden the land gives back.
I've had enough of this.
Yeah, it's a funny thing, but that all of this takes me back to why the talking about these stories and telling these stories are so very important. Because we need to look at things, I was going to say logically, but that's a waste of time. Nobody's going to look at them logically. Look at them with open eyes and open hearts, and realize that, yes, and this goes back to something you said quite a bit earlier, is that the same stories or similar stories keep showing up in different parts of the world. Thing with the church bells all over the world, that people are the same in many cases. That's one of the things that we share. We share as a species, and one of the things we share, of course, is this love and belief in story. And the story helps us with what's happening today.
Yep.
What happened yesterday, what's going to happen tomorrow. So the more you know about it, the more familiar you are with it, the more immersed you are in it, the better off you are to be able to handle what's going on, I think.
Yes.
Mind you, I happen to revere story, so that and story to me is not a lie. A lot of people have an argument with story. Story is something that has a beginning, middle, and an end, and it just is a structure.
Yes. I think sometimes you can be quite surprised as well about the differences culturally that you can find across the world. I've long been fascinated by bathroom ghost stories, Gail.
Oh, yeah.
And as you say in the book, over here in the West, it's all about saying somebody's name in a toilet mirror, Candyman or Bloody Mary. But obviously you go to parts of Asia and there's some very strange stories. I mean, my friends married a woman from Hong Kong. He's lived out there 20 years. He teaches English as a foreign language there, and he's now based in Hong Kong. But he's told me many stories of some of his wanderings working in Shanghai and other cities in mainland China. And so I've always been interested in this, but I'd never heard of one of the characters that you mentioned in your book, which is this delightful demon called Akaname, who is the toilet licking demon.
I do save a lot of, I do collect a lot of the Japanese, because they're so, I don't know how to say it. I mean, they have these specific duties or specific likes, like licking toilets. Like that's what they do. That was a fascinating one for me as well. But yes, the toilet ghost, your colleague probably really gets nervous if it's on the third floor. Because most of these stories take place on the third floor, for some reason or not, in Japan anyways.
Yes.
And then somebody like J.K. Rowling takes it and puts Myrtle in her story, and then all of a sudden people know that have no idea about toilet ghosts before
yes.
are now familiar with a haunted bathroom.
Yes.
That's where popular culture comes in.
Yeah. There are some strange things about some of them as well. I know there's another one you mentioned, which is Akamanto, which reminds me very similarly, and I've forgotten the name of this particular ghost that's supposed to inhabit sort of alleyways and such like in Japan as well, where this one, you've got this story about student desperately needs the toilet, and the only toilet that seems to be working is this one that's a bit dirty and a bit dreary. And they get in there, they do what they need to do, and then they realise there's no toilet paper. And then a voice says, do you want the red paper or the blue paper? And it's one of those scenarios that it doesn't matter what answer you give, you're going to die. And I can't remember the name of the ghost that hangs around in alleyways, but that's a similar kind of thing, that she is this beautiful woman from the back, and then she turns around and her mouth's completely sliced up her face. And if you say she's ugly, she kills you. And if she says you, and if you say she's beautiful, she kills you. There is no way to get out of these scenarios. And I was quite surprised about the toilet version, because I didn't realize it had got that side to it as well.
Okay, the one in the alley, if you give her a certain kind of sweet, she's fine.
Ah, good.
Okay, carry pockets of that with you.
Excellent. I'll ask you for them later then.
Yeah, okay. But yes, I mean, one of the things that has happened, of course, in Japan is that before the stories were sort of got out to the West, they were localized. And so you had similar stories, but in different localities. So this one took place in bathrooms, and over here it took place in an alley. And here, but then all of a sudden, we're starting to hear those stories, and they're starting to, they show up in our manga, they show up in anime, they show up all over the place, and we become familiar with them, and we realize what a rich world that is, and how strange it is. And if you want dark, go to Japan, because some of those are very, very dark. I did not include them. Right, too much. I mean, these are murderous ones, but not as bad as some of the others, if you like.
Absolutely. I'm well versed with Japanese horror, so there's not much that frightens me. But even that, honestly, it's a different level of fear. Japan and Korea, I don't know what they've been doing the last 30 years, but my goodness, they don't know how to terrify people. I think the last thing I'd like to touch on before I let you leave, Gail, if that's all right, is this is something, once again, that seems to be prevalent all around the world, and is this connection with crossroads. Here in the UK, famous, we would bury suicides here, or we would hang highwaymen on crossroads as a warning sign, and have gibbets up and all sorts of things. There is a pub in Sheffield which is called the Noose and Gibbet, which was where one of our local gibbets used to hang up until the end of the 18th century, I think, early to mid 19th century, it was finally taken down because they decided that corpses swinging in the wind were not the best advert for the area. But I think most people, if they think about celebrities and music, even Robert Johnson is synonymous with crossroads, because you've got this story all about this man's incredible talent for the era, and the fact that surely only the devil could learn somebody to be able to play the guitar as well as he could. And clearly Johnson must have met the devil at the crossroads, and sold his soul, Gail.
That's right. He did, because he learned how to play the guitar so quickly and so well. He could not have done it just with practice.
No.
It doesn't work that way. And because I think the story even has more potency because of the way he died, which was also mysterious. So you have a mysterious beginning. You have that mysterious middle, if you like, where he becomes the famous musician. And then at age 27, which, you know, is a very famous age for musicians.
Yes.
He dies, and he dies in such a strange way again. Nobody knows exactly what happened. So all that mystery together, you know that the devil had to have something to do with it. You do. That's all there is to it. Particularly when you realize that the whole thing about the crossroads and, you know, is an ancient belief. And so this is a modern incorporation. And it's not, I mean, it didn't stop with Robert Johnson. It's continued on, but he still is the placeholder. He's, you know, he's still the most recognized musician that that happened to. But it happened to others before, and it happened to others, or will happen to others in the future. But Robert Johnson not only had that mysterious death, but he sang about the crossroads. Not about his meeting, but he did sing about the crossroads. But yeah, and that crossroads is magic in many, many cultures.
It's remarkable how far back that goes, because I think the first instance I'm aware of is Greek mythology, Gail. So we're talking thousands of years that there's been this power associated with crossroads, either on a subliminal level or a physical level. It's almost as if it is an embodiment of the choices some of us have to make in life. We go one way or the other, but we don't know which path will lead us where. You've just got to go and hope for the best.
And it's interesting because it's not a Y intersection that takes you A or B. It is a crossroads because you can get there two ways in many cases, or you can turn around. I've always found it fascinating. And you have to be careful about crossroads, right? You never know. That's my whole life. You never know.
Just to be safe. You just can't tell. But it's striking, I think, that it's always had that power over people for whatever reason, Gail. And at the end of the day, we're just talking about a path or a road. It's
two paths.
Yeah. It's not, you know, you don't even have to put a graveyard on it or a spooky wood or anything. No. It can just be a flat field with a crossroads in it. As long as you've got two roads crossing, all of a sudden it seems to get some kind of power beyond what you would normally expect to see. And it doesn't seem to affect cities, because there'll be lots of crossroads in cities, Gail, all around the world. As far as I'm aware, there may be one where you might see a ghost or something, but I'm yet to see one where you've got a crossroads in a major city that seems to have a reputation that some of the other ones. I mean, obviously the Johnson one's quite famous because I believe there's a sign on a crossroads in Mississippi, but it's not, that crossroads didn't exist when he was alive.
No, it's not the right place. That road doesn't exist anymore. Whatever crossroads he may have crossed on, that's not there. But yes, you're right. It's rural. It's because, again, we're going back to the power of story, is that all surrounding that crossroads is the unknown. It's either the forest or this wide open space or a hill. There's not a lot of people. There's not a lot of activity. There's a place where it's just you and whatever's at the crossroads. And so it can't be in a place that's populated unless it's in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, fabulous. It's a wonderful collection. And I know, as I said at the beginning, you've had a stellar career as a lover of stories and someone that wishes to share and encourage and keep these alive. When you look back, Gail, are you surprised to see how many of some of these ones that perhaps 25, 30 years ago you might think will have died away as the internet appeared, that have suddenly, they're here again? Like, these are stories that cannot die, and the internet has simply just protected even more of them.
I know. yes, I am often surprised. I am often... I was going to say horrified, but that sounds like I'm disappointed. I'm not. I'm just sort of aghast at how some of these stories have regained in popularity, because what does that tell us? I always want to know, what does that tell us about what's happening? And so then I have to look back and think, okay, this is when the story was popular before. What is the similarities to now, and how do we get there? So that's why sometimes I'm horrified, is because maybe we didn't need to do that again, or maybe we haven't changed that much. But at the same time, a good story is a good story. And if you have a collection of stories, like some of these have been collected for a long time, and all of a sudden somebody's reading an old collection and they go, oh, this is a brilliant story, I'm going to tell it. And so they start telling it, and then it starts circulating again. Or there's a trigger because something happened that is similar to something that happened in that story, and it becomes relevant again. So I'm surprised, but not surprised, I'm always surprised, but not surprised that it happened. That's the only way I could say it.
Even in the modern era, the power of stories doesn't diminish. If anything, they seem to be more powerful now because they have a bigger audience.
Exactly.
Fabulous. Well, it's a wonderful book. I recommend it highly for anybody who's got an interest in supernatural, strangeness, stories that their friends tried to pretend it was them when they were children, anything that wants to remind you of some of the teenage stories you were heard and people pulling your legs. So where can people follow your work, get a hold of this and some of your previous books that you've released, Gail?
Okay, I have a website, storytellerdeboss.com. The book itself, this one is Watkins' book. In North America, it's sold through Penguin. I always recommend people buy it at their independent bookstore. Watkins Books have it in the UK. It's available. My other books, just as a quick segue, my other books were all educational books, and they only since recently, have been available to a wider population rather than the educational publication. This is the first book I've written that's actually open to everyone. But because of Amazon and because of the internet, the other books are available as well. And do not forget to go to your local library. That's always a good place to start.
Absolutely. I chime with everything you've said in regards to supporting independent bookshops and libraries, Gail. And I want to say thank you so much for joining me the first time. I hope I get a chance to speak with you again, because I could have carried on for hours, Gail, picking your brains and diving into this, because you've got a wonderful history. And it's a wonderful book, like I say, in parts hilarious and in parts terrifying. And we all need to be aware, because as you say, what if? Thank you very much, Gail.
Thanks, Paul. Take care.